Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 19. I'm going to cover verses 1 through 21, the entire chapter. I will entitle this chapter Cities of Refuge and Laws Concerning Witnesses. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, Deuteronomy 18, verses 1 through 22, we looked at legal provisions, the laws concerning provisions for the priests and the Levites and their support, and then we looked at laws against occult demonic practices. So let's start now in Deuteronomy 19, verses 1 through 3. When the Lord your God cuts off the nations whose land the Lord your God gives you, and you dispossess them and settle in their cities and in their houses, you shall set aside three cities for yourself in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God gives you to possess. You shall prepare the roads for yourself and divide into three parts the territory of your land which the Lord your God will give you as a possession, so that any manslayer may flee there. Now, this is Moses again. He gave three discourses to the Israelites as the Israelites were on the plains of Moab, getting ready to cross over the Jordan into Canaan land, under Joshua, not under Moses, who was getting ready to die. And so Moses is given his farewell speech, and in this second discourse, which has been going on for quite a while now, he's emphasized the law and obedience to it. The first discourse he gave was his inveighing against idolatry. So in verse 1, when Moses says, when the Lord your God cuts off the nations, he's talking about the Canaanites, the seven Canaanite nations there. And then he says you should set aside three cities of refuge. Now, we've already talked about three cities of refuge when we went over Numbers 35, and also in Deuteronomy 4 it was mentioned. It will later on be mentioned in Joshua 20, and here it is mentioned in Deuteronomy 19. So these cities of refuge were very important. Remember, the Pentateuch, not just Deuteronomy, but all of the Torah, the Pentateuch, was basically a legal document. And it set up a legal system, and so legal things were very important. Now, these three cities that are mentioned here were placed strategically, it says, in the midst of their land. And if you recall from the previous exposition of the cities of refuge in Deuteronomy 4, there were also three in the Transjordan area in the east. Here, Moses is only talking about the three cities in the west, on the west side of the Jordan. He says these cities are to be in the midst of the land. Why does he say in the midst of the land? Because the cities would there be conspicuous, accessible, and equidistant, as Jameson Fawcett Brown says. I have a map of the three cities of refuge. The northernmost one was right there, just northeast of Lake Hula, which is the little body of water to the north of the Sea of Galilee. It's Kadesh. That's the first city of refuge. The second city of refuge is Shechem, the place where Abraham first went when he came from Haran into the Promised Land. Shechem, the city between Ebal and Gerizim, about halfway between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. And then Hebron, which is south of Jerusalem, about halfway down the Dead Sea on the west coast, equidistant. Kadesh, Shechem, and Hebron. Now, while I'm doing this, I might as well tell you what the cities on the east side were. Going from north to south, Golan is the first city. Of course, that's in the area due east of the Sea of Galilee, where the Golan Heights are today. You go south a little bit, just north of the Jabbok River, you got Ramoth-Gilead. And then you go all the way down to the plains of Moab, where Moses is speaking from now, and you got Bezer, which is the third city of refuge. Now, let me give you a few review facts about the city of refuge. John Gill says that the surrounding nations also had cities of refuge, but those cities were different. They gave refuge to any kind of criminal, a rapist, a murder, of intentional murder. But these cities of refuge in Israel were only for unintentional deaths, manslayers, not murderers, manslayers. So that was a little different. The purpose was to give the avenger of blood time to cool off. Well, who's the avenger of blood? That's a relative who sees his relative killed through negligence or through an accident, and he says, I'm going to kill you because you killed my relative. So the manslayer needs a place to go to hide out for a while so that the avenger of blood would have time to cool off. I mean, after all, after a while, after time goes by, the avenger might decide since the homicide was an accident, there's no need to avenge the death, and thus there would not be an unjust murder taking place if the manslayer were to be killed. Now, the Levites were in charge of these cities of refuge. Why? Well, they were the most suitable and impartial judges. they might be able to still the passions of the blood avenger. So the Levites, one of their main functions besides keeping the temple, was handling lawsuits as judges. Now, Adam Clark makes the point that nowhere do we read that these cities of refuge were abused. We do not read that they were inefficient. Apparently, they worked very well. Now, we're going to see in just a minute in Deuteronomy 19, verses 8 through 9, that there were three more cities that were to be added as the territory were added. That's a little bit problematical. We'll take that up in just a minute. It's not clear whether that means three more cities or whether it's referring to the three cities on the east side, Golan, Ramoth, Gilead, and Bezer. Now, we might ask the question, well, the cities on the west were taking care of population for 9.5 tribes, whereas the cities on the east were taking care of the population of 2.5 tribes. That doesn't seem to be balanced. Well, the answer to that is any manslayer on the west, if he finds that there's a jam in the court system in Kedesh, Shechem, and Hebron in the west, he could always cross the Jordan River, go over to the east, and that would balance things out. The cities were fairly close to each other, east to west, as well as north and south. In other words, you could get to one of those cities if you needed to quite quickly. And in fact, verse 3 says the roads are to be prepared. Verse 3 says, you shall prepare the roads for yourself. And the point of that was to make it easy for the manslayer to get to the city of refuge. Now, Adam Clark has something interesting he's gotten from rabbinic literature. Quote, the Jews inform us that the roads to the cities of refuge were made very broad, 32 cubits, and even so that there should be no impediments in the way, and were constantly kept in good repair. So the roads were wide, they weren't rough, and they weren't blocked by anything. Straight road right into the city of refuge. Here's what Jameson Fawcett and Brown says about these roads. Quote, the roads leading to them, to the cities, were to be kept in good condition, and the brooks or rivers to be spanned by good bridges. The width of the roads was to be 32 cubits, and at all the crossroads, signposts were to be erected with the words, Mekaleth, Mekaleth, refuge, refuge, painted on them. Mekaleth means refuge. It's kind of interesting. Verse 3 says that the land to the west of the Jordan was to be divided into three parts. And of course, that's because the cities were equidistant, north to south, and so the three parts were equal to each other. Now, Moses was dealing with a well-established custom. The well-established custom was the blood avenger, the next of kin, could track down and kill a manslayer. Well, Moses took the established institution that was already there, and he improved it. Now, you might ask the question, well, why did not Moses just say that manslayers are innocent until proven guilty of murder? Well, the answer to that is the avenger of blood would most likely nail the manslayer before he got his trial. We can say that now, but back then, that's not the way it worked, and so Moses had to deal with established customs, kind of like he had to deal with polygamy, slavery, things that not exactly good, but that's just the way it was, and he had to deal with it. Just because the law deals with something doesn't mean the law approves of it. After all, we have laws against prostitution in the big cities. Does that mean our courts approve of prostitution? Well, up until recently, I would say no. Who knows now? But just because you regulate something, we regulate divorce. Does the law approve of divorce? Deuteronomy 19, verses 4 through 7. Now, this is the case of the manslayer who may flee there and live when he kills his friend unintentionally, not hating him previously, as when a man goes into the forest with his friend to cut wood, and his hand swings the axe to cut down the tree, and the iron head slips off the handle and strikes his friend so that he dies. He may flee to one of these cities and live. Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue the manslayer in the heat of his anger and overtake him, because the way is long, and take his life, though he was not deserving of death, since he had not hated him previously. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall set aside three cities for yourself. Now, in verse 4, the unintentional aspect of manslaughter is mentioned when he kills his friend unintentionally. That's extremely important. There's no malice of forethought. There's no lying in wait. There's no premeditation, because that would be murder, and the cities of refuge didn't apply to murder. There's an example of an unintentional killing that's given here in the law. Verses 5, man goes into the forest with a friend to cut wood, and the axe handle separates from the axe head. The axe head strikes his friend and kills him. Well, first, why do we know this is not intentional? Well, because it was his friend. Friends usually don't kill each other intentionally. And so that's evidence that this was not a premeditated murder. Now, of course, when a person claiming refuge in a city of refuge claims that refuge, he's got to prove that his homicide that he has committed was not done with malice aforethought. It was an accident. Or doesn't really say what happens if it's negligent. What happens if the man that's swinging that axe had the axe head on the top of the axe handle attached negligently? Well, it's still not premeditation. Now, in our law, we would say that was manslaughter. And so I suspect there would be restitution involved, but you don't execute, you don't let the kinsman avenger execute somebody who kills somebody negligently, and especially not accidentally. Another thing that shows the unintentional nature of this homicide is this: when the man goes into the forest, he's not breaking into a private home. That would show premeditation. A forest is a public place, so everybody has a right to be, so it would not be surprising that two friends would go into the forest, and the person committing the homicide would not have the intention of killing his friend. He goes in there with the intention of cutting wood. So that's a fairly easy legal fact situation there. But again, the law, of course, uses examples, and the judges have to reason from the facts to other cases. We go down to Deuteronomy 19, 8 through 10. If the Lord your God enlarges your territory, just as he has sworn to your fathers, and gives you all the land which he promised to give your fathers, and by the way, that land was from the Wadi El Arish, the brook at the southern tip of Israel, which divided Egypt from Israel, all the way north and northeast to the Euphrates River. So if God enlarges your territory, as he has promised, if you carefully observe all this commandment which I command you today, notice that the taking of the land is always contingent upon obeying God's commandments. That's repeated over and over and over again in the law. If you carefully observe all this commandment to love the Lord your God and to walk in his ways always, then you shall add three more cities for yourselves, for yourself, besides these three. So innocent blood will not be shed in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, and blood guiltiness be on you. The innocent blood that's being referred to there is the manslayer who kills somebody not with intention. And if you kill that manslayer, if the avenger of blood kills that manslayer, then there would be blood guiltiness on the land, because then that would be a murder. That would not be justice. Now, there's a question about these three more cities. Does this refer to when the Israelites expanded to the northeast and got to the Euphrates, they would add three more cities in addition to the three that are already there on the east of the Jordan for a total of nine? That's what John Gill thinks, apparently. I think he thinks that. But the time never came, because the conditions of observing the commandment in verse 9, that condition was not met. Now, one reason the condition was not met, assuming these three cities were supposed to be laid out as the kingdom of Israel extended to the Euphrates River as it did under Solomon, the reason that the three cities of refuge were not set up is because the territory there in the north and east was taken and governed by tribute. The people there gave tribute to Solomon. The Israelites were too few in population to actually be able to colonize the area. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. In point of fact, although that region was brought into subjection by David and Solomon, we do not find that cities of refuge were established, because those sovereigns only made the ancient inhabitants tributary instead of sending a colony of Israelites to possess it. The privilege of sanctuary cities, however, was given only for Israelites, and besides, that conquered territory did not remain long under the power of the Hebrew kings. Well, if Moses here in Deuteronomy 19 is referring to cities of refuge 7, 8, and 9, they never were established. However, as Adam Clark says, it's probably just the other three on the east side of the Jordan for a total of six, which, of course, that was actually carried out. And I tend to think that's what the answer is right there. We go now to Deuteronomy 19, 11 through 13. But if there is a man who hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him and rises up against him and strikes him so that he dies, and he flees to one of these cities, then the elders of his city shall send and take him from there and deliver him into the hand of the avenger of blood, that he may die. You shall not pity him, but you shall purge the blood of the innocent from Israel, that it may go well with you. So if the Levite judges in the city of refuge decides that the man who's fled there is not a manslayer, but is actually a murderer, well then, the murderer is to be delivered to the manslayer, to the avenger of blood, and the murderer will then be executed. So it's sort of like privatizing the prison system or the judicial system. Executions will be carried out privately by the avenger of blood. That's the way they did it back then. Now, Moses exhorts, well, this is Moses quoting God, verse 13, "You shall not pity him," not pity the murderer. And why is that mentioned? It's mentioned several times in the law, don't pity the guilty party. Well, I think this is human nature here. It's often difficult to carry out executions for capital crimes. I mean, execution is a serious business. Now, especially, as John Gill says, if the criminal is a prominent citizen, a neighbor, a relation, a close friend, a rich man, you know, it's hard to pull the plug, hard to pull the switch on people like that, or hard to stone people like that. But God says you've got to purge Israel from murderers. You can't allow murderers to get away with it. Apparently, Moses is inveighing against bleeding-heart liberals, and apparently bleeding-heart liberals are not merely a modern phenomenon. They had them back then, too. It wasn't so bad. Let's let him live. Verse 13 says that if you let the crime go unpunished, the murder, not the manslaughter, but the murder, if you let it go unpunished, it won't go well with you. But if you do purge the blood of the innocent, that means purge the blood of the innocent means the innocent man dies. His blood's lying on the soil of Israel, and it cries out to heaven for justice, and so you got to purge that blood. In other words, get rid of the innocent blood by convicting the murderer, the person who caused the innocent blood to be shed. If you don't do that, it won't go well with you. If you do it, it will go well with you. Over and over again, obey the law, there's blessings. Disobey the law, there's cursings. It's everywhere in the law. Deuteronomy 19:14, "You shall not move your neighbor's boundary mark, which the ancestors have set, in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God gives you to possess." Well, of course, if you move your neighbor's boundary mark, you will move the boundary mark closer to his property and further away from your property, so that your property will be enlarged and your neighbor's property will be shrunk. Now, stealing property this way was considered an especially serious crime, as the NIV Study Bible says, because remember, back then in agricultural society, land was money. We see the same attitude toward property thieves in Deuteronomy 27:17. "Cursed is he who moves his neighbor's boundary mark, and all the people shall say, Amen." Remember, back then they had no way to survey boundary lines like we have today. I mean, today we take, the surveyor gets out there, surveys the land using GPS, gets it down to a degree, a minute, and a second, creates a plat. The plat's recorded in the courthouse, and now everybody knows every inch of their own property. They couldn't do that back then. They didn't have the technology. So boundary marks are very important. The Romans actually deified their boundary marks. This is a god. Leave it alone. Why was there so much concern about boundary marks? Well, it was easy to move them. Go out into the woods, go out next to a brook or something, nobody's around, you move the boundary marks, and the next thing you know, you've just stolen some property. A serious crime, easy to commit. So not only the Israelites, but also other ancient Near Eastern countries had to really come down hard on that. We go now to Deuteronomy 19, verse 15. "A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed." Now, this verse proves that the requirement for two or three witnesses is not just required for criminal cases. It's not just required for capital cases, but it's for any criminal case. Numbers 35:30 says that two or three witnesses are required for a murder case. "If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses, but no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness." So it takes more than one witness to execute, to convict somebody of murder. Here it's a single witness shall rise up against a man on account of, shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity, not just murder, any iniquity. Here's some other scriptures about this two or three witness requirement. Deuteronomy 17, verses 6 through 7. "On the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witness shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people, so you shall purge the evil from your midst." There's the idea of purging again. Two or three witnesses, Matthew 18:16. This is the famous church discipline chapter. spoken by Jesus. If he, that's the offender, does in the church, if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every fact may be confirmed. That's the second stage of church discipline. When the offending brother does not listen to you, the offended brother, you take two or three witnesses so you can establish the facts. This is just common procedural sense. 2 Corinthians 13:1, Paul says this, "This is the third time I am coming to you. Every fact is to be confirmed by the testimony of two or three witnesses." Paul refers to that. He says, "I'm coming to you the third time, so my testimony of what I see there in Corinth is the third time, and that means it's established, it's fact." 1 Timothy 5:19, Paul says this, "Do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of two or three witnesses." Hebrews 10:28, "Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses." Now, let's examine this two or three witnesses a little bit closer. If you had a choice between two witnesses or three witnesses, what would you rather have? Well, three would be better than two, but two is sufficient. But remember, those two witnesses have got to persuade the judges that the alleged offending party is guilty. It's easier to convince a judge with three witnesses than it is with two witnesses, but it is possible. But the testimony, the evidence has got to be pretty strong. It doesn't matter how strong the evidence is with just one witness, you're not going to get a conviction. Let's say that I alone saw somebody kill somebody else. It was broad daylight. I wasn't drunk. I wasn't asleep. I've got no reasons to be prejudiced against the accused. And I've just got reams of evidence. Doesn't matter. It takes two witnesses. We're not going to take a chance to execute somebody because one witness might be prejudiced against the accused. Here's another issue that might arise with the three witnesses. What happens if you get two out of three of the witness say that the guy is guilty, that the accused is guilty? Is that enough? No. Three witnesses means three witnesses who will testify to his guilt. They have to unanimously agree to the guilt. So now we go to Deuteronomy 19, verses 16 through 19. "If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, then both the men who have the dispute shall stand before the Lord, before the priest and the judges who will be in office in those days." Notice how priest and judges go together, because many of the priests served the judges, just as the Levites did. Verse 18, "The judges shall investigate thoroughly, and if the witness is a false witness, and he has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him just as he had intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you." So let's say that I testify that John Doe has stolen a refrigerator, or the equivalent of a refrigerator in the times of Israel, and I lied about it. Then I will have to bear the same penalty that the accused would have had to bear if he had actually stolen the refrigerator. So I will have to pay to the court the value of the refrigerator plus 20%, because there's always 20% added on. And so the false witness will have to pay instead of the falsely accused. This is, of course, referring to cases in court. This is not talking about just somebody lies about you. Deuteronomy 5:20 has this law too. "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor." Perjury is a serious crime. Serious crime. That's why the courts tend to prosecute it if they get a chance. Here's another verse that's related. Leviticus 19:11-12. "You shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another." Now there, it's not lying in court. That's just lying to one another. Verse 12 of Leviticus 19. "You shall not swear falsely by my name so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." Now there, I assume it's in court. But of course, if it's wrong lie about your neighbor in court, it's also wrong to lie about him in public. It's just a little bit more serious when you do it in court. "Get rid of the perjurer, thus you shall purge the evil from among you." Verse 19. Now, I mentioned earlier that this purging of sin from the people is extremely important in Deuteronomy. Let me read you the verses. Deuteronomy 17:7. "The witness's hands will be the first in putting him to death. And after that, the hands of all the people, you must purge the evil from you." That's in the case of a murder. Deuteronomy 13:5, "But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has counseled rebellion against the Lord your God, ... so you shall purge the evil from among you." Get rid of the false prophet. Deuteronomy 21:21, "Then all the men of his city will stone him to death. You must purge the evil from you." and all Israel will hear and be afraid. That verse is referring to a rebellious son. He might stir up dissension and pretty soon start revolts, and pretty soon you got the Israelites in the desert in a civil war. Deuteronomy 22:24, you must take the two of them out to the gate of that city and stone them to death. The young woman, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he has violated his neighbor's fiance. This is the case of an engaged woman who goes out and gets it on with a boyfriend or somebody that's not her fiance. And she was in the city, which shows that she wasn't raped. And so you purge the evil from you, people who violate marriage vows. Deuteronomy 24:7, if a man is discovered kidnapping one of his Israelite brothers, whether he treats him as a slave or sells him, the kidnapper must die. You must purge the evil from you. So now kidnappers, purged. Now Paul uses this idea of purging. He gets it from Deuteronomy, 1 Corinthians 5:13. But God judges outsiders, put away, i.e. purge, the evil person from among yourselves. A little bit of leaven leavens the lump. So you purge the evil or it will spread. Deuteronomy 19:20-21. The rest will hear and be afraid. The rest who? It means the rest of Israel who wasn't a false witness, who wasn't that false witness who was executed. The rest will hear and be afraid and will never again do such an evil thing among you. Thus you shall not show pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Now, when it says the rest will hear and be afraid, this illustrates the fact that the law has deterrence within it as well as punishment. In other words, the law is a deterrence as well as punitive. Now, of course, in discussing these issues of the law and what the purpose of the law is, the modern sociological leftist liberal humanist view of law is that we can take these good people who've just gone wrong because if they were badly influenced by the environment, and we can just put them in jail and we correct them and we will rehabilitate them. If you notice, that's why they call prisons correctional, so it's because it's supposed to correct them. Of course, you know, these sociologists rarely look at the recidivism rates, which are extraordinarily high because people don't get corrected so easy. Well, the purpose of the law is to punish. It is not to rehabilitate. Now, if you get some rehabilitation, fine. But now a lot of people, for example, when defending capital punishment, will talk about the deterrence effect. And I understand that that's not necessarily true, that laws against capital punishment laws do not necessarily deter criminals. As a factual matter, I don't know whether that's true or right, not true or not. But I tell you, if somebody cold-bloodedly murders somebody, in my opinion, rapes somebody too, they deserve to die today, right now, in 21st century America. But back in Israel's time, there was deterrence. The rest will hear that this false witness was executed, and they will be afraid and will never do again such an evil thing. So nothing wrong with deterrence, using the law as deterrence. Verse 21 says, thus you shall not show pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. And what that means is don't underapply the law. If somebody does something seriously, seriously punish him. Now, of course, that phrase could also work the other way. Don't overapply the law. If somebody has a speeding ticket, drives his camel too fast, don't execute the driver of the camel. That would not be just. Justice is even-handed, equal punishment for the crime. But here it's under application of the crime. Do not show pity again, because judges tend to not want to carry out the law because it's kind of a hard thing to do. For example, to execute somebody for capital crime. Now this eye for an eye, which is very famous, of course, even in our non-Christian culture, this principle is stated in Exodus 21:24-25. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Again, equal-handed justice is the idea. Leviticus 24:20. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him. And by the way, we should say, it was not literally inflicted on him. If somebody put out somebody's eye in a fight, let's say he attacked him and put out his eye, you don't put out the eye of the aggressor. There was a way of calculating a monetary value for that eye, and then he would have to pay a monetary value for the eye, plus probably a 20% penalty too. But they didn't go around knocking out teeth because somebody else knocked out a tooth. That wouldn't be just in the case of a one-eyed aggressor who knocked out an eye of a offended one. And so then the judge says, okay, we're going to knock out your eye. Well, then you make the aggressor totally blind, whereas the aggressed against would still have one eye. So we need to be careful here. This is just talking, sets up a principle, equal justice, and it was going to be carried out by converting the physical damage to a monetary equivalent, as John Gill points out. Now, of course, this eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is famously quoted by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 38 through 42. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. This is quoting the Torah. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. Now, what Jesus is doing here is reacting against the Pharisees' perversion of the law. They were using the law as an excuse for private revenge. Oh, you slap me on the face, well, I'm going to go after you and slap you on the face. That's not what the law was meant for. It was meant just to, as a warning to the judges to practice even-handed justice. That's all it was. It wasn't an excuse to go out outside the court system and start beating up on people that do you wrong. People who love to take the Sermon on the Mount literally like that, they don't take some parts of the Sermon on the Mount literally. For example, if your eye offends thee, pluck it out. How many times you see people doing that literally? Well, anyway, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Deuteronomy chapter 19. In our next audio, I will tackle Deuteronomy 20, verses 1 through 20, the entire chapter, and we will look at laws concerning warfare. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion.